Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can our shared history tell us about our future direction? While America's most vehement social and political conflicts feel very much of the moment, the truth is that we have been debating the proper context for war in American foreign policy, religion in American society, and the impact of ethnicity and immigration on American life for well over 200 years. So what do these long-standing arguments reveal about our strengths and weaknesses, and to what extent do they define what it means to be an American? Simon Sharma is professor of history and art history at Columbia University. He explores these issues in his latest book, The American Future, A History. Hi, Simon. Welcome back to Think. I'm sorry about the technical glitch. It's good to have you.
Yeah.
If an understanding of our past can't tell us about the events in our future, what can it predict?
It's not a matter of predict. Like, we're not really supposed to be in the prediction business, actually.
That's for
tea leaf readers, really. But it can actually. You can't. It's something you can't do without. You know. I mean, we do have the kind of historian in chief in the White House, whose cabinet seems to consist of Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And you need to take on board the experience that America has had. I mean, if you think about it for a minute, it can't possibly hurt to know about the way we came out of the Great Depression or the way we got into it in order to deal with our problems right now.
Do you think that we Americans accurately interpret our own history and what it says about who we are as a people?
Well, you know, we're a lively and vigorous and testy democracy, and that, from as Alexis de Tocqueville noticed, is our strength. Foreigners who came to the United States in the 19th century felt how contentious it was, how everybody was shouting at each other, but that's actually our strength. It's our virtue, I think. There are always going to be debates. There were among the founding fathers. There were between Jefferson and John Adams. And the sort of vigorous exchange of quite opposed views is what keeps us honest and healthy, I think. So there isn't a kind of correct version about being American. For example, let me give you one example. You know, is big government disgustingly un-American, or is absence of government, the kind we witnessed after Hurricane Katrina, un-American? That's what we Americans row about all the time, and we should.
So you take these four concepts in the book, war and religious fervor and immigration and ethnicity, and then plenty to the extent that we have natural resources, and you use them to sort of define who we have wanted to be.
Yes.
Why did these ideas in particular strike you as the core of Americanism?
Well, there are others, of course. You know, one could talk about, you know, populist democracy and so on. But I was really thinking, because I was running around America with a film crew, looking at the campaign and then brooding on the history backstories, about the huge stories that were going to remain once the election was over. And none of us, certainly not, you know, me, quite saw the sort of financial cyclone that was about to hit us. But I do still think that these are the four stories. Who we are as a people, can, you know, ought we to be anxious, really, about America being what one of my interviewees in Dearborn, Michigan, called the coloring of America, and he was kind of white American Muslim. Should we be anxious about running out of natural resources to which we felt entitled for a long time? And I have in mind in the book and in the films water as much as oil. These are all things that it seems to me go to the heart, and especially backpedaling too much, I think the sense, should America be thought of as a moral community or not? Most of the founding fathers thought it should. These are all issues which really go to the heart of discussions about our national identity and our national future at what is clearly a crossroads in our history.
You write that until this year and this election, Lincoln's government for the people, of the people, and by the people was a promise incompletely realized. What tells you that that has changed?
I'd say the 44th president of the United States.
Well, I mean, I understand that, but maybe you can talk.
Well, that's really what I meant. I mean, we if there was a sort of original sin in the Declaration of Independence, and you do hear my British voice there, although I regard myself as having two identities, American and British. But if there was an original sin, it was, of course, Jefferson promising equality and saying that all men are born with the natural rights, inalienable natural rights, to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, while at the same time being a slave owner. And until that issue of freedom acquired on the backs of a slave population came all the way around the possibility of African Americans who had once been slaves being treated as equal citizens with equal rights, we weren't going to get that that shot of that particular millstone around our democratic necks. So that's what I meant about the incomplete realization. Frederick Douglass, the great orator and first great author of a slave narrative, said woundingly, what is it to me, your 4th of July? But, you know, now the president can celebrate the 4th of July in confidence that it is his 4th of July as well.
And it does, and it comes through in multiple places in the book, that American culture is, we're often called uniquely optimistic, but it's also uniquely future-focused.
Well, you know, it's very why I begin the book with an epigraph from Jefferson, who stole it, really, from Cicero, saying that unless you are part of the past, you don't really understand the future. It's quite true that we are focused. We're an energetic and optimistic community, and then we are focused on what is realizable in the future. But look, isn't it also the case that, you know, the great beach blockbusters of the summer are yet another doorstopper, life of Benjamin Franklin or John Adams or Alexander Hamilton? This is what is very difficult to explain sometimes to my friends in Britain and Europe, that they all think of America, as Gore Vidal unkindly put it, as the United States of amnesia. But the fact is, because the Constitution is a living, breathing document that has to be interpreted there every week the Supreme Court is in session, we tend rightly to think of the Founding Fathers not in their kind of wigs and hose, but as walking and talking to us right now. And for a historian, that kind of, what I call it, vital ghostliness is really a wonderful thing, actually.
And of course, the Founding Fathers have wonderful things to teach us and to show us. And there are also things about them that if we could change the past, we might. It's an interesting reminder when we look at the way we argue today over ethnicity and immigration,
right,
that Benjamin Franklin, who Americans love as this sort of avuncular, wise spirit, was very concerned that the country would be ruined by an influx of Germans.
You really want to tell him to calm down, don't you? Yeah, it was extraordinary that he was so obsessed with the wonderfulness of the Scotch, the Irish, and I think running a third, the English, that the notion that, you know, Germans were unfit for democracy was preposterous, really. And, you know, successive waves have always felt, people who've been readily settled in the country at every generation have felt the next bunch of foreigners who were queuing at the door of Ellis Island or wherever, Angel Island, were somehow weirdly culturally, if not racially, unfit to be citizens. And that's, of course, actually, you know, an appalling cloud that's hung over the greatest of all American dreams, the notion that irrespective, I think I say in the book, of your tribe, your birthplace, your nation, you become American by subscribing to the democratic ideal. But, you know, I mean, what is, I think, fantastic about America is that you really want the ideal to have flourished in all its intensity and in sincerity in the first place. But you also would be a dishonest American if you didn't register the fact that it had often been violated as much as it had been faithfully observed.
Do you think, Simon, that there is anything fundamentally different about the resistance to the current wave of immigrants from a closer, faraway place, from Latin America, than there has been to immigrants that have come from anywhere else?
No, I mean, I think it's a sobering fact. If you go and look at the way in which people talked about the Chinese in the 1870s, people, after all, had, you know, revolutionized the country by working on the Pacific Railway and uniting the two coasts through an incredible Herculean sacrifices, but the Chinese regarded almost as subhuman. There were pogroms, mob riots, Chinatowns burned down. There's quite a horrific level, actually, of ethnic and racial violence, which thought that there was never a possibility that Chinese immigrants could ever be compatible with membership of the American democratic community. It wasn't until the 1940s that people of Chinese origin who had not been born in the country were granted the right to become citizens. That's really sort of scary. So, you know, there's massive amount of evidence all through our history that we've been as frightened of the changing of the core values, as they're sometimes called, of sort of Anglo-Scottish European stock, as we've been excited by it. But nonetheless, America time and time again has changed and been enriched by that experience.
Does an immigrant nation to a certain extent, sort of require some other to come in and allow everyone else who's been here for two decades longer to feel more American based on the fact that they have that time and that experience as Americans?
Well, that's the way it seems to work, doesn't it, actually? But the question is actually whether or not those who can feel superior in their prior Americanness, whether it's, you know, the Italians, for example, once from Sicily and Calabria, once reviled as the scum of the earth, then becoming super passionate Americans and looking very doubtfully on, let's say, Russian Jews, who are the next bunch to come in, or whether or not they're ready, settled Americans who see themselves really as tutors to the experience of becoming American. And the latter group, you know, might have been a minority, but they've taken those duties of tutoring very seriously, and it continues to be the case. You know, teaching in universities, for example, we constantly, it's a wonderful thing, which really did not happen when I was teaching in Britain, one sees over and again new generations of Americans coming in, their children plunging into the pool of American democratic life, Cambodians, Vietnamese, Russian kids, kids from Africa, with the same kind of optimistic determination that their predecessors had. And it's a moving experience.
It's also sort of fascinating about our culture in that while there has always been resistance to some group coming in, you know, everybody else is okay except you, we also have throughout our history congratulated ourselves for being open to immigration.
Yes, and you know, there is, it depends where and where you look, I suppose. We shouldn't really be ashamed of that congratulation, but it should be diluted with sobering honesty. For example, it was correct, I think it's correct to say that, you know, the gates were open in the end of the 19th century and the very early 20th to hundreds of thousands of the destitute and the persecuted. But it's equally important to say that that all stopped after the First World War. And we have some very dark passages to acknowledge. You know, I'm Jewish, and it would have been much better if America had honored its promise to rescue those in various kinds of distress in the 1930s, for example.
Yeah, it's your sense that we could have saved millions more from the Holocaust had we opened the gates and allowed them to emigrate easily and quickly.
It would have been good to have had a quota that was somewhat bigger than 20,000, yeah. Mm-hmm.
My guest is Simon Sharma. He's professor of history and art history at Columbia University. Do you think, Simon, that there's an advantage to being both a resident of the United States and also having the ability to sort of look at this country from the eyes of a foreigner when you're looking at our history?
I guess. I mean, you know, a friend of mine, actually, with whom I made the BBC films, went along with the book, called the book a tough love letter, really, which I think is true. The book doesn't claim to be the sort of son of Alexis de Tocqueville. No one could really reach that level of distinction or insight. But I've been here a lot longer than actually Alexis de Tocqueville. I like to think, certainly, that it gives me a perspective. What I do hope it does, I mean, when the book came out and it's now being published in a lot of other countries, a Brazilian edition appeared this week, for example, that it allows me actually to be a kind of interlocutor, an interpreter of the complications of the American experience to other parts of the world that sometimes have an oversimple idea, for example, about American religion.
Let me stop you there because we need to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a minute. Simon Sharma is my guest. The new book is The American Future, A History. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Simon Sharma. He is professor of history and art history at Columbia University. His newest book is called The American Future, A History. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Simon, I'm sorry I had to cut you off to take a break a moment ago, but you were leading into the way that Americans have viewed religion throughout our history.
Yes, I mean, I was saying, Chris, that actually it's always been a source of grief to me, actually, that the view commonly, particularly from Britain, which is, shall we say, sort of usually sardonic about professions of faith. We don't do God, is what some politicians say. The notion that intensity of religious belief and the role it sometimes plays in politics is captive to the fundamentalist conservative right in America. And I was concerned to say that, for one community, in particular the African-American community, religion has been progressive, and that it's impossible to think, for example, of the abolition of slavery without the participation of Christian preaching and teaching. So the issue for which links the past and the present is whether it's important for President Obama to really recreate the notion of the American community as, above all, a moral community, and what the dimensions of that kind of morality and character, that kind of morality, actually are. So we did, both for the book and for the films, we encountered many different kinds of religious experience, and tried to trace the history of what ought to be, the hallmark of American experience, namely its bet on toleration. The bet that Thomas Jefferson made in the Virginia Statute of Toleration was that if you let 1,000 flowers of religious passion bloom, they would not want to persecute each other, or that they should, in the Constitution, be prevented from criminalizing any kind of religious belief. And that's a flag we should fly from our flagstaffs, it seems to me, at a time when the world has much to deal with in the shape of fundamentalist theocracies.
Well, it's really important to remember as well that these ideas about preserving the freedom to practice whatever religion we choose, or no religion whatsoever, if that's the case,
right. Actually
predate the Constitution. Can you talk about Roger Williams?
Yes, Roger Williams was the most wonderful crank in American history. Really. I love him.
That's saying something.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Yeah. You mean it's a long list to choose from? Surely not, Chris. Roger Williams was the founder of Providence Plantation, which became Rhode Island, or as more orthodox Protestants like to call it, Rogue Island. And the reason they did that, and they thought it was a kind of nest of grazes, was because Williams thought of Massachusetts as a false place of freedom, somewhere to which, after all, Protestants who are Puritans, who were themselves persecuted back in Britain, had fled in order to create their own little free Jerusalem. But as it turned out, when Roger Williams got there, he did not like the notion of a church court. He hated the idea that Governor Winthrop, author of the famous City on the Hill, not Shining — Shining was something added by President Reagan — but the City on the Hill could actually lock you up for failing to attend church, to be caught drunk in the street, and so on. And, Roger Williams was an ardent churchgoer, a preacher himself. I doubt if he was ever caught drunk in the streets. But he thought it was really immoral to actually have the civil power be able to prosecute someone for their belief or the lack of their belief. So he underwent a long, difficult journey to somewhere in the watery wilderness, where he founded Rhode Island, the place to which anybody of any faith, or indeed, as you say, Chris, rightly, none, could come and could remain there unmolested by the civil power. And that was something which is absolutely unique in the world at the time.
And that also included the Jews in Rhode Island.
It did include the Jews. Mm-hmm. The first Jews came to Rhode Island in the 1650s from the Dutch West Indies. The Dutch were relatively tolerant, but not in New Amsterdam and New York, where they weren't particularly tolerant at all. And the Jews found a home in Rhode Island, and indeed, very movingly, as they're described in the book, just shortly after the Revolution, when George Washington and Jefferson come to Newport to stump for the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights, they petition Washington to clarify the position as a government, as to whether or not Jews would enjoy full civil rights along with their Christian co-religionists. And Washington was charmingly hospitable and encouraging to that. And that, again, was a real page turned in the history of toleration in the world, and certainly important for the Jews.
Of course, it would be some time before a Jew would hold any kind of national or regional office.
Yes, that's quite true. You have to go much further into the 19th century, actually, and to some chagrin for those of us who are staunch liberal unionists, they held quite high office in the Confederacy, Judah Benjamin, as well as on the side of the good guys.
Simon Sharma is my guest. His new book is called The American Future, A History. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Juan in Dallas. Hi, Juan.
Hi. I love your show.
Thank you.
I just have a brief comment. And I'm from Hispanic and Native heritage. And I just don't understand. Every time there is some kind of expert talking about the problem of immigration in the country, they mix the two of illegal aliens and immigration. I cannot understand that. If people immigrated from Europe, they cannot come illegally. They have to come with some form of abiding by the rules. And illegal aliens are not. And I sort of get offended every time I hear somebody saying about immigrants when, in fact, they're illegal aliens, that they violate our rules and laws in the country and have no idea as to what the system is or what it's supposed to be doing in terms of being an American.
Well, thank you very much for your call, Juan. Simon, what do you think about that distinction and how it's used and when it's used?
Well, I don't think I wasn't trying to fudge this year. I don't think we were talking about it, but it's a good, very good question that Juan asks, I guess. Let's, without dwelling too much on the difficult, painful Chinese experience that we talked about a little earlier, the Chinese were legally here, actually. They had permits that were granted to them in mainland China. They came to do work that no one else would do, dangerous work, which many of them died under the drifts of snow crossing the Sierra Nevada. And then they were treated with physical brutality after that, actually. So that it's not really a very edifying place in American history. Chinese would have loved to have had the possibility of becoming legal immigrants, but they weren't, as I say, sort of allowed that until many generations had passed. And this is a kind of painful story that we should acknowledge if we're going to be honest about American history. Now, that having been said, I understand Juan's concerns to keep the distinction, but it's also true to say that this is, I think, something that the last two presidents would actually share. We have a very large population in this country of undocumented aliens who nonetheless would like nothing better to find a path to citizenship. And that is something that President Bush was very concerned to make possible. He ran foul of his own Republican Party in that respect. And it's certainly something which looks to be important for President Obama, has already spoken out about it. And I suppose one might be consoled by the fact that the economic downturn has meant that the number of undocumented aliens and illegal immigrants coming into the country has dropped dramatically because job opportunities in the industries in which they were concentrated, like the construction industry, have all but collapsed. But it will be a much deeper issue for us. The fundamental issue is America one thing? I mean, is it supposed to be one color, one belief, one culture? Or is the glory of America, as a lot of its most interesting writers and chroniclers have tried to say, precisely in its heterogeneity, in that it is genuinely e pluribus unum, that what unites us is our allegiance to democratic ideals. It's the honor, for me, I would say this quite straightforwardly, the honor of American history is that it does not believe there are any racial groups in the world, any cultural groups in the world, who are somehow unworthy and are somehow faulty material to be made into democratic citizens.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Simon Sharma is my guest. The new book is called The American Future, A History. Let's go next to Al in Fort Worth. Hi, Al.
Hi. I was wondering what the guest thought about maybe the difference in impact that the current wave of immigration will have on America because of the fact that, say, in the past, with Italians and Irish, there was a giant body of water separating the immigrants from their homeland, and there wasn't regular travel between them. Whereas now, for example, Mexican immigrants are frequently going back and forth between Mexico and America. So is that going to change the way that we see assimilation happening?
Very interesting point. Geopolitics. I have to say that even though it was a giant body of water, you'd have very, you know, ships would dock at New York sort of about every 2 minutes. I'm exaggerating a bit. So that because the appeal of America to those who were destitute and persecuted or both was so strong that they were prepared to endure real hardships in order to make it to Ellis Island or to try and make it to the West Coast in the case of the Chinese. So it may just not be geography that is the determinant. But I hear that the very interesting and rather subtle part of your question, Al, right, is whether or not you think that the shifting quality of, the sort of fuzzy sense of the border, is this what you mean, may sort of perpetuate a sense of double allegiance?
I'm thinking that that's what Al...
Yeah, but I think that's... You know, that's legitimate. I mean, we talked in my book, I talk about this wonderful group of musicians just outside Brownsville called the Chicken Club, who meet every day to do Norteamericano singing very beautifully, too. And we asked them, did they feel Mexican or American? And they gave a double answer. They said, well, we feel very Mexican. You know, that's who we are. But then you wouldn't have, you know, it was immediately followed by an absolute passionate defense of the United States as the greatest country in the world, the place they were honored to be part of. And yet they were, you know, they had very little English, I have to say, even though they've been in the United States and in Texas for 20, 30 years. The issue, I guess, is can you have both identities? Can you be passionately Irish or Cambodian or Mexican and still ultimately actually have your allegiance to the democratic United States? And, you know, those of us who are optimistic and about this sort of multicultural quality of the United States, very much hopes you can. This is the only country in the world in which you can be patriotically hyphenated.
As wonderful as this part of the discussion is, I don't want to miss out on also talking about this debate that we've had from the earliest history of the country, over the value of militarism, as far
right.
back as the legendary clash of ideals between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton.
Right.
Can you talk about the roles that each man played in shaping and maintaining a great nation in terms of how we would use our military?
Yes, this is such an important question. Thank you for asking it. And it is so moving to go back to those debates because everything is, in the best sense, dewy and innocent and slightly virginal about the possibility of what America would be. America, after all, the experience of the Revolutionary War, and I say this again with my British accent, was essentially, as it was looked at by people like Thomas Jefferson, the rebellion of ordinary people against the paid hirelings of George III. In other words, it was the birth of a new kind of nation which was fundamentally anti-militarist in its leaning. The irony and the difficulty is once that job had been completed so gloriously and the Minutemen and the popular militias had been demobilized and had gone home, ought there to be a standing American army? Ought there to be a professional officer corps? And Alexander Hamilton, who'd fought himself with great bravery, if not reckless temerity, often at the side of Washington, said, in effect, look, it's a dangerous world out there. We're going to be a great power, whether you farmers like Jefferson like it or not. That's our destiny. Why would we be the only power in the world to have one hand tied behind our back? We need a proper military college. We need to train artillerymen. We need to understand military science if our fledgling democracy would survive. Thomas Jefferson said, that's the worst future you can imagine for America. The world out there is full of Napoleon Bonapartes, who begin by pretending they're Democrats and end as tyrants. The world is full of people who commit what we now would call coup d'etat. It's incompatible with democratic freedom to have an American professional permanent officer class. And the most extraordinary surprise, the most moving thing for me, which is why I spent a good bit of a chapter on it, Chris, is that it's Jefferson who is the most suspicious about the place of the military in the life of the nation, who founds West Point. Precisely, this is often forgotten. It wasn't Hamilton who had the idea of a college. It was Jefferson in 1802. Precisely because he said, this will be a place where all of our officers will be Democrats first and soldiers second. We will teach our young men civil engineering. They will build bridges. They will build roads. They will protect our country in case of natural disasters. And this debate really goes on to this day. What are the wars worth spilling the blood of our children and the money in our treasury for? What is the difference between a war of necessity and a war of choice?
What's so fascinating about that is that I would imagine that today both sides of this question would want to claim Thomas Jefferson.
Talk to Dick Cheney about that. I think actually he would claim Alexander Hamilton probably and Donald Rumsfeld. I mean, there is a side even among the Democrats too. If you go back to Harry Truman and Scoop Jackson and Democrat hawks, and I rather think our present president is, you know, something of a hawk in Afghanistan, and they would see themselves as hard-nosed pragmatists about what it takes for America to survive in a world not necessarily friendly to democracy.
Simon Sciamma is my guest. He's professor of history and art history at Columbia University. His new book is called The American Future, A History. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Simon Sciamma is my guest. He's professor of history and art history at Columbia University. His newest book is called The American Future, A History. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, and that is where we find Gina in Mesquite. Hi, Gina.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Well, my concern is this. Being of Cherokee descent, a lot of times we hear historical recounts of our country's birth and the issue of the absolute genocide that was done against the Native Americans always seems to get not mentioned. And even in our schools, our children are not being taught this, primarily in Texas because it's not on the tax test. But it's a concern that I've not heard anything of that in what I've heard thus far.
Okay, Gina. What you have to do this afternoon is to go out, Could I Be Biased, and buy my book, where you will find 35 pages devoted to what happened to your people, to the Cherokee, at the hands of Andrew Jackson. Why don't you join me in starting the campaign to remove Andrew Jackson, our very first ethnic cleanser, from the $20 bill? That would help for a start, wouldn't it? You have a point. It's very, very important. There is currently a beautifully written biography of Andrew Jackson by the excellent John Meacham that's a bestseller that, in my view, goes very, very lightly on what happened to the Five Nations and the Trail of Tears. It can't be said that the Trail of Tears hasn't been acknowledged. I should explain to the listeners who don't know about that, is that the Cherokee originally came from the Appalachian areas of Tennessee and Georgia. And that they were settled there, and that they were received, their leaders and chiefs were received by Thomas Jefferson, who more or less cut a deal and said, the problem you have is that you can't be American citizens until you're settled farmers, until you're educated, until you have your own schools and so on. And that's exactly what happened. The Cherokee had one of the most interesting newspapers in all of American history called the Cherokee Phoenix. They did everything that Thomas Jefferson asked of them. They were prosperous, successful, enterprising farmers. They were model American citizens, but they had the misfortune to to be living at the site of the first American gold rush. Who out there are going to put up your hands and say you know where the first American gold rush was? Because it was in Georgia in 1829. And all of those promises that were made were swept aside by Andrew Jackson in 1830, who basically deported the Cherokee along with the Creek and the rest of the five civilized tribes over the Mississippi to what was then called the Great American Desert, now Oklahoma. And it was one of the most tragic episodes in American history. And I wouldn't necessarily agree with Gina that it's unknown, but should it really be part of our national story? You bet it should.
You alluded briefly earlier in the hour, Simon, to the role of religious Americans in fighting against the scourge of slavery. Were religious Americans also active in trying to protect the rights and the welfare of Native Americans?
Well, very interesting, actually. At the time of the debate over the deportation, the kind of forced deportation of the Cherokee, often it's said, well, we have to understand the mentality of people at the time. It is not the case that Congress was silent about that. Speakers like Henry Clay and many others in Congress, actually, at the time of the debates in the late 1820s and early 1830s, said this would be a moral blemish on the honor and moral integrity of the United States that would haunt it for the rest of its life. So people, you know, I think actually, oddly enough, I think they were more morally intense about the fate of Native Americans before the Civil War than they were after, when the railroads opened up the country, the kind of race for homesteading was pell-mell, there was great pressure because of the increased numbers of immigrants on available land. But you can find fiercely dignified and honorable speeches being made about the fate of the Native American population in that earlier period in our history. It's very interesting.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Kelvin in Richardson. Hi, Kelvin.
Yes, my comment was kind of back to what the Cherokee lady was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like the story paints more of a rosy picture than actually looking at America's success is actually based on despair. If you look at the way it turned out was, you started out with indentured servants, then you moved to slaves, and then and now you are into the age of immigrants. But it seems like no one, when they talk about American history, they don't really talk about how it's really, the success is always based on despair.
Well, you know, that's not the D word, like defeat, despair, demoralization isn't one I would ever use. I think if you'd use the word, I've forgotten your name, I'm so sorry.
Calvin.
If you'd use the word suffering, I would agree with you. But I wouldn't agree with you that it's missing from American history books. Even the more boring social studies, a phrase that I wish was abolished, even from the more boring social studies textbooks in high school are full of the problems of suffering. What's really inspiring about the experience, and by the way, the president, you'll remember, Calvin, alluded to these darker moments in American history in his inauguration speech when he talked about the tough life that immigrants had to endure in steerage or destitute out on the prairie or under the lash of the plantation overseer. What's always very inspiring is actually how people who had to endure these troubles somehow had the courage and fortitude and determination and ultimately optimism that the American dream would eventually be extended to them to get through it. And even if they didn't get through it themselves, believe that their children would. And that, for me, you know, as an immigrant myself, is really something that deserves to be celebrated, but in an honest way, in a way that's alongside the truth about all the darker passages in our history.
Why, Simon, has it taken so long for Americans as a culture to recognize that our natural resources, the things on which we grew up and grew rich, are in fact finite?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. It's true that if we're talking about the general population, it may take the, you know, $5 a gallon tank of gas, which is sort of, you know, the problem is that people are going to be relaxed now. It's back down to $2.50 or something, and get those Hummers out from the garages all over again. But there's a long cultural explanation without being too professorial about it. But this huge continental expanse that stretched out beyond the Mississippi all the way to the West Coast seemed to the most boosterish American American optimist, being provided by God as a place of unlimited fertility. All you had to do was apply a little sweat, a little spit, stick your hoe and your shovel in the ground, and up would pop what, alfalfa, wheat, oil, you name it, America had it. But of course there were Americans who said, hold on a moment. And in one of the chapters of the book called American Plenty, I talk about this extraordinary American hero, one-armed ex-veteran of the Civil War, John Wesley Powell, who was the first figure to make it all the way down the Colorado River, right through the Grand Canyon that nobody had survived before. Powell was someone who knew more about water resources in what he called the Arid West than anyone else in the United States, and became head of the first American Geological Survey under the presidency of President Grant in the 1870s. Everyone was expecting Powell to say, now we've tamed the Colorado, now we know what it's like, we have enough water to make the desert bloom. But Powell actually disappointed all of his supporters at the end of the 19th century, who with the expansion of the railway wanted to see massive settlement in states like Arizona and Colorado, by saying, wait a minute, there is only a very limited amount of this territory that can be intensely irrigated. We have to be good stewards and not simply prodigals about the way we use our water resources. And now if you go and look at Lake Mead, with running just about below 50% capacity, and the water situation in the lower Colorado states absolutely dire, to the point that water rationing is not inconceivable in the next 5 or 10 years, you realize how intelligent and prudent people like John Wesley Powell were. No one could accuse Powell of being a kind of wuss, of being not a true American can-do patriot, but he was intelligent. Americans sometimes are reluctant to hear the bad news about their environment, and that's another challenge that the president will have in somehow not making Americans feel pessimistic, but making them be realistic about what we can and can't do.
Do you think that sense that these things have been provided to us by God, not because we're individuals, but because we are Americans, is that responsible for as many of our failures as a society as for our riches?
Well, it's, I'm going to do the awful professor thing, six and a half a dozen of yell. You don't want to lose this extraordinary sense of American resilience. But it's a resilience that really, when intelligently deployed, produces something like, Google. Or it produces the greatest search engine. That's the spirit. You know, Benjamin Franklin would have recognized that right away, that when you're out of black gold, when you're out of oil, turn your ingenuity, turn your resourcefulness to something which had been waiting there that you can actually develop without any illusions that simply riches is going to come to you by virtue of the fact that you were born in the United States. So in some sense, you don't want that sense of belief in American ingenuity ever to go away, even if we are at the beginning of the end of the internal combustion engine. But the collapse of Detroit and Dearborn is a very, very kind of almost tragic case study in the slowness with which we're adapting to the necessities of America evolving into a different kind of American century.
Is anti-Americanism also a time-honored tradition?
Yes, and it comes from snobbery, ignorance, laziness, the tendency of much of the world to see America in terms of stereotypes. They always infuriate me. You know, I've lived half my life here. I've lived more than 30 years in the United States. And it always bugs me, really, that both the negative and sometimes even the kind of more adulatory positive stereotypes are just the sort of desperate need to have America sketched out with a very, very broad brush, just as nothing about America to Europeans was much good in the last 8 years. Nothing about Barack Obama's America could possibly wrong now. And both sorts of pictures are really oversimple. You're never very popular, when the old professor comes trundling along and says, hold on a minute, it's more complicated than that. Do a little more homework and let me help you, nosegays are not thrown in your way for saying that. But that's the truth about America as much as it's the truth about Europe.
So how much control do we have ultimately in sort of guiding the rest of the world understanding of who and what we are?
how much control. We don't have control, you know. Those of us who write about the United States or write about history can just sort of pitch our tent and hope to draw people into it. Nobody, I think, in America. I mean, I've been in China and India a little bit over the last few months. Very interesting in China. You'd think, really, that the Chinese are now our creditors. The Chinese on whom we now depend because of the holding they have in our bond market would be in a gloat mode. But, you know, really, that's not true. It was quite touching talking to people quite off the record who are desperate for the American model, which they feel they've been following, not to fail. America still represents a kind of political and social magic in the world. It still has that bright morning, dewy, virginal innocence 1776 about it for all kinds of populations around the world. Now, we don't have control of sort of explaining that life is more complicated than that, but we perhaps are in a position of gentle, impassioned givers of tutorials about America. And that may be the best we can hope for, but it's something to aspire to for those of us who are writers, I think.
Does the gravity of our current situation help President Obama to the extent that Americans, at least temporarily, are fixated on the need for a strong leader as opposed to viewing everything he does through those old lenses of race and ethnicity?
Yes, I really, and that's a fantastic point, Chris. I mean, that's the view I have. I thought it was very interesting when it came down to it. Of course, it was a truly moving and revolutionary moment, really, when Obama was elected. But, you know, I think he was elected in states which you wouldn't have a bet would have been in his column, like Indiana, not because of his skin color, not because of his personal history or his ethnic history, but because he just looked like the competent executive, especially when standing next to John McCain. It was an extraordinary irony that the Republicans thought that in a match of who had experience, who had competence, who Americans trusted with their government at a moment of meltdown, it would be the skinny kid from Harvard in the knockoff Armani suit who would look like an American leader, not the great veteran general, a veteran soldier.
Simon Sciamma is professor of history and art history at Columbia University. His latest book is called The American Future of History. Simon, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.